Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck, the only program I know of where a Pulitzer Prize winner can put a whole radio show on hold so his super can take out his garbage. I'm John Schaefer, and still to come on the program, the alt-country band Sun Vault will perform live in our studio. But first, if you've been to a symphony orchestra concert, you may have noticed that the musicians on stage are overwhelmingly white. In fact, blacks and Latinos make up about 3% of the musicians in America's orchestras. But did you ever consider whether there's a link between what orchestras look like and what they sound like? Would racial diversity equal artistic versatility? Exploring this question with us today are three guests, and to start with, we'll have two critics. Justin Davidson is himself a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic, music critic of Newsday here in New York, and Christopher Orlett is a St. Louis-based journalist who writes for the American Spectator magazine. Chris joins us on the phone. Justin's here in our studios, and Justin, let me begin with you. You recently wrote a column in Newsday in which you, among other things, quote Aaron Dworkin of the Sphinx Organization out in Detroit. He suggests that there is a connection between the way an orchestra looks and how it might sound. How does that play out? How would that play out?
Well, I don't want to speak for Aaron Dworkin, but in my mind, it's not just a direct chain of causality that if you have more black players, you're going to have more pieces by black composers, or if you have more Latino players, more salsa-influenced music in the symphony. I think the point is that the racial imbalance in American orchestras is reflective of a very narrow population from which American orchestras draw. And what I've been trying to say is that if you could find a way to open up that population, draw from a wider pool socioeconomically, geographically, racially, that you would strengthen something that's already a strength of American orchestras compared to orchestras in a lot of other countries, which is their versatility. I mean, I think the American orchestras do have a more versatile spectrum of musicians in them.
So are we talking about making the music, the whole experience of symphonic music, somewhat less elitist by, you know, opening it, as you say, to other socioeconomic and racial communities and bringing that kind of flexibility to the orchestra?
Well, less elitist in the sense that, you know, it's much easier for somebody who's growing up in an overwhelmingly white affluent suburb to get the kind of exposure in school that might eventually lead to a career as an orchestral musician than it is for somebody, you know, in an inner city school to take two extremes. But the reality is also that even in the broad spectrum of American schools, even in overwhelmingly white schools, the exposure to classical music is very difficult to come by. And, you know, that's really at the heart of this issue.
All right, let me bring in Christopher Orlett in St. Louis. Chris, you wrote a response to Justin's column and argued, and I'll quote here, "If ever there was a case for elitism, it should be made on the world's great orchestral stages where perfection should never be held hostage to political correctness." What did you mean by that?
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
What I'm trying to get at is I don't really mean elitism as in, you know, all one color. I'm all for opening up classical music to minorities, bringing in minorities. I think that orchestras do a fine job of reaching out. But really, is that their job? They're not schools. They have their own job to do.
I think a lot of the orchestras would argue that, you know, while they are not schools, the schools are not doing that job either, and that you know, someone needs to kind of get that pipeline, that potential pipeline of of younger talent from other communities open and flowing.
That is absolutely correct, and I agree with Mr. Davidson that the schools are not doing their job, and the orchestras are kind of being scapegoated. And I think that we have some wonderful outreach programs, but I do believe it's up to the schools and to the parents to develop an appreciation in children and students in classical music.
All right, Justin, you alluded to this already, that even with the orchestras predominantly white as they are, compared to other orchestras around the world, quite versatile in the types of music that they can and often are asked to play. So how big a problem is this from a musical standpoint?
Well, it's a problem in the sense that there is a wide sector of the population that isn't, you know, whose creativity is not being tapped. That's very hard to measure. You know, in days when women were excluded from orchestras all over the world, you know, how big a problem was it that half the talent pool wasn't being tapped? Well, you know, you look at technically what's happened to American orchestras in the period since women were in large numbers allowed into and recruited for American and American orchestras and orchestras around the world. And, you know, I think there's no question that it's become a much more competitive business, and the technical quality of orchestras everywhere, certainly in the United States, has risen dramatically. So, you know, that's one issue. And another is just musically. I think that we live in a period when the boundaries between different kinds of music, you know, as you see so clearly on this show, are really very brittle. And when you have an orchestra of, I mean, I think this is sort of a generational change. When you have an orchestra of people who are brought up with all different kinds of music and not with these cubbyholes, you have an orchestra that can do that much more.
Right.
How composers use that, it's hard to know.
And of course, if it is going to do that much more, you want to be able to have more people coming in to enjoy what that orchestra is doing. And Chris, I suppose some would argue that an orchestra that looks more like its community is more likely to actually get that community to get into the hall, to attract a new audience. Do you agree with that notion?
Well, I know that a lot of people make that argument. But I think we're talking high culture here, aren't we? And how much of the population is really going to develop a love or an interest in ballet, opera, theater? These are cerebral arts, and they're just not cool. So, you know, I think about 10% of the population. Now, if you could get more minorities in that 10%, that would be wonderful. If you could get more working-class whites in that 10%, that would be wonderful. And again, I think, but I don't think what you want to do is establish a quota system.
Mm-hmm.
I think this has to be done on merit, on skill, on hard work, and on talent. And again, I think it's up to the schools and the parents, and it's just a matter of priorities.
All right, you've touched on a real key issue here, which is, you know, how you go about making those hiring decisions when you're in orchestra. And I want to get into that whole topic in a moment. But here's an example. The 20-year-old Chicago Sinfonietta is 35% people of color, and many of its employees and board members are also black or Latino. The group champions black composers like George Walker, like this composer, Adolphus Hailstork. And this is what they sound like.
Thank you.
some music from Adolphus Hale Stork, African-American composer, an American port of call recorded here by the Chicago Sinfonietta, which is, as I mentioned earlier, bucking the trend as it is more than one-third black and Latino in the orchestra pit. We've already met two of our three guests as we're talking about the changing or unchanging face of American symphony orchestras, Justin Davidson, the music critic of Newsday, and Christopher Orlett, St. Louis-based journalist from the American Spectator magazine. And joining us now is Dr. Aaron Flagg. He is a board member for the American Symphony Orchestra League and also executive director of the Music Conservatory of Westchester. And Aaron, just before we heard that bit of music, Chris mentioned the process of hiring. You know, we don't want to have quotas and stuff. The hiring process has been a subject of debate among the American Symphony Orchestra League and outside for 30 years or more now.
Definitely.
Tell us about, you know, the screened audition program that was begun in the 70s where people don't know whether they're hearing a white musician, a black musician, a male or a female. Has that worked for women? Has it worked for black and Latino musicians?
Well, that's a great question. The blind audition process, which was actually ratified by the two major musicians' unions in the early 80s, is really perceived in our field almost like the Holy Grail. It has become the thing everyone points to as the panacea for all ills as it relates to hiring, which is interesting to me, knowing more of the history of where this comes from. And actually, I think history and context are often things forgotten in this discussion of diversity in orchestras. But in terms of the hiring practices, as anyone could imagine, if you're behind a screen and we're only listening to the sound of your instrument, that just salivates to be able to focus on the artistic merit. Mm-hmm. And to that extent, I would agree that that's the case. But like in any hiring practice, you can only hire from the pool of candidates that are available at the time you have to hire. And the ability of any organization to attract the most qualified candidates has also to do with the culture of that institution and how it's perceived. So although, yes, since the blind audition process has been instituted, many ills like conductors choosing their favorites or mm-hmm. teacher choosing their students or other unsundry reasons for hiring people have been reduced, if not eliminated, we hope. It was not intended to solve all the ills it's now being assigned to have addressed.
Okay, so it was not intended to raise the overall level of minority participation.
Absolutely not.
Which we keep throwing out the 3% figure. That's blacks and Latinos.
That's
yes. overall minority participation in American symphony orchestras, the figure I've seen is 14%.
That's not 14%.
14%, but that's including the Asian population.
Right, and as was mentioned off the moment ago, that's in our field, when we define diversity on the stage or, frankly, even more importantly, on the board and in the staff, we're really talking about Latino and African-American principally.
Is that because the Asian community is so well represented already?
Basically, that's the case. In our field, the Asian community, wonderfully so, has really not only embraced this music, but really has full participation in all levels of the orchestra, as we see from the orchestra, the league's perspective, nationally.
All right. Justin Davidson, you spoke to Aaron Dworkin of the Sphinx organization, which, you know, has its own orchestra of black and Latino players and really is trying to create a pipeline for younger black and Latino musicians to get a step up in the classical music field. What was his take on the screened audition process, and what's your take on his opinion?
Well, he thought that it was insufficient, and that I think he went a little bit farther than I would in saying that the cultural background, and let's distinguish that from race, but that the cultural background that a musician brings to a job in a symphony orchestra is important. I think we agree on that. He went a little bit farther in saying that that should be a criterion for hiring, as it is a criterion in, say, admission to selective universities. That diversity is in itself a goal worth organizing the hiring process and adjusting the rules around.
All right. Now, Chris, in your article, again, out to Christopher Orlett in St. Louis, you refer to Aaron Dworkin as a bigot because he's suggesting that you know, that it would be great to have a whole orchestra of, and he does have a whole orchestra of Black and Latino musicians. I mean, let's take a very tangible example. You have an audition process. You have two players who are more or less equally qualified on artistic levels. Is there any reason not to go with the minority candidate in a situation like that?
Well, there's no reason to go for that candidate either, I don't think. I don't believe that just because a musician comes from a different background, say a Cajun background, that he is going to bring something. I mean, he will bring that Cajun style to classical music, but when you actually get down to playing the classical music, how much Cajun influence is there going to be in that piece?
Right, but I guess what I'm asking is there a tipping point? You know, it can diversity be, all other things being equal, should diversity be the thing that tips you in the favor of one candidate as opposed to another?
Well, I guess I would go along with that.
All right, Aaron.
Just to get Chris off the hook to a certain extent, because I know he's sweating this out. The fact is, in hiring in this field, there as a frankly probably the only orchestral musician on this panel, the reality is beyond playing the isolated snippets of music we call excerpts behind a screen with no accompaniment, no other musicians in your area. Besides that, which is what blind auditions really are. When you really play in an orchestra, there are chamber music skills required, blending, mm-hmm. flexibility required. So there are actually, purely in a musical sense, many skills that the sacred blind audition never touches
okay.
that become critical.
I want to ask Chris another question. And then Aaron, as an African-American yourself who's, you know, obviously worked his way pretty high up in the American Symphony Orchestra League. I mean, what was your experience of classical music growing up? What was it like in the community where you lived? Were you the exception? Were you the only kid among your family and friends who even knew what this was? Give us a little bit of your personal experience.
Quickly, I'm from Los Angeles, and when I grew up in the pre-Prop 13 era out in California, for those who know, that's when music was really ripped out of the schools, and I saw that in seventh grade as it saw it all go away. My neighborhood was that, stereotypically. I never shared what I was playing in the basement at home. People would never understand that playing on the playground. It was not something my parents knew intimately, although supportive of my studies. It was a strange thing to do, although I should add my twin brother's an opera singer.
Uh-huh.
And just got back from Israel, so I guess the whole family is strange.
Something in the DNA, yeah.
But the fact is, the music itself and the musicians on an individual level, my teachers in the LA Philharmonic and others, are welcoming, I should say, to everyone. And the issue is larger that the orchestral field in the last 15, 20 years is really starting to embrace a different view of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Away from the origin of a private club, which it was when it started, to really viewing itself as a community resource. And that is making these changes in education that we honor through the MetLife Community Engagement Award, Bank of America Education Awards, are really about how orchestras themselves as a whole are really embracing a community view.
Maybe that's
various reasons.
Maybe that's just a first step, but a necessary one. Back out to St. Louis and Christopher Orlett, you argue in your article that we should use the analogy of professional sports as a model. And, of course, when the major leagues, baseball, were opened to players from the old Negro leagues, the whole level of competition really, just took off quite dramatically. Realistically, though, where there are so few role models for Black and Latino kids, whereas there was a whole Negro league back in the day, is it possible to use that analogy in orchestral music?
Well, I guess I'm talking about today and not 50 years ago. 50 years ago, right, there weren't many women in orchestras. But since then, women probably make up half of the students in Juilliard today. I'm looking more at the NBA today. You're going to go out and you're going to get the best players, regardless of their background or their skin color or whatever. And you're not going to say, well, we need the NBA is too segregated. We need some 5 foot white guys on the team. You know, so it looks like America.
That wouldn't be enough.
Wouldn't help the Knicks anyway.
No.
Justin, let me ask you to also be realistic as we wrap up here. I mean, this is a problem that can be attacked on multiple levels. Where do you begin? I mean, if you were named czar of orchestral music in this country, what would the number one step be to fix this?
Well, you don't begin by changing the screened audition process, I don't think. You do begin, you know, at the beginning of children's involvement in music. You make it much more available at the early stages in schools, and you do that, you know, on a nationwide basis. I would look at two foreign countries and for, you know, some sense of what can be done and what the obstacles really are. One is Venezuela, where there is a nationwide system of youth orchestras that is largely, if not completely, funded by the government. Has gone through various different political regime changes and is dedicated not to producing professional musicians, although it has.
Most notably, Gustavo Dudamel, the newly named conductor of LA Phil. Yeah.
Right. But its real mission is to rescue kids from the street. It has a social justice mission to give them something to do and specifically to be in an orchestra.
Okay. And then very quickly, the other country?
And the other country is China, where it's a huge and growing market. Where did the cultural exposure for that come from? I don't think it's enough to just say, well, you know, that's not part of their culture.
Yeah. Well, it's a provocative issue. It's a vexing question, and we've been talking about it with our guests, Justin Davidson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic of Newsday here in our studio, Christopher Orlett, the journalist from St. Louis who writes for the American Spectator, Aaron Flagg, board member for the American Symphony Orchestra League and executive director of the Music Conservatory of Westchester. And a gentleman to the three of you, thanks very much for being with us this afternoon.
John.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on the program today, a live performance by the band Sunvolt. Their new album tackles themes of restlessness, paranoia, and information overload. Stay with us for Soundcheck.